Tonight on Randomness, Chance Probability reveal a tremendous amount about our daily lives. This is going to be a fascinating program. The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. Leonard Mlodinow is up next on Coast to Coast AM. You get a chance now to listen to Leonard Mlodinow. He received his doctorate in physics from Berkeley. He teaches about random processes to future experimental scientists at Caltech. Now, along the way, and this is fascinating in his career, he also wrote for the television series MacGyver and Star Trek The Next Generation, co-authored A Briefer History of Time with none other than Stephen Hawking, and he's our guest now on Coast to Coast. Leonard, how are you, my friend?
Oh, great, George. How are you?
It's been a long time since you've been on the program, hasn't it?
I think about 3 years,
maybe four years. Longer. Man, not by chance either, right?
No.
Hey, tell me a little bit about your career. I'm fascinated with your background. I mean, getting the doctorate in physics, you're a real scientist, and you're also a very home run hitter writer, and then a television series. How did this all happen?
Well, I always like both science and writing, and people find it odd because they view science and the arts as being quite different, but actually science is much more creative than people think. And granted, you don't work with the English language, you work with mathematics instead, but they both at heart are enterprises that you have to be very passionate about, that have a certain amount of romance and take a lot of creativity to do well. And it's just different ways of expressing that. Since I was good in math, I could do the mathematics, and I've learned how to express myself with the English language as well. So,
and I can't ask you what you prefer better, writing for TV shows or writing books or real science. I bet you like them all.
I do like them all. The one that I would probably like the least is the writing for the TV shows, because you don't have the independence that you do when you write books or when you do science. There's a lot of people telling you what to do, and there's a lot of constraints on what the TV show has to be.
What was it like working on Star Trek, The Next Generation? That must have been fun.
Well, that was fun. And one of the fun things about it was that it's not often that you write something and, you walk down the street and get in some casual conversation with somebody and they start quoting back to you what you wrote. I mean, maybe with The Drunkard's Walk that'll happen. but Star Trek was such a popular show and affected people so deeply that was really interesting to see how involved people were in what was going on the TV.
Well, that's fantastic. Hey, tell me, what was it like working with Stephen Hawking, Leonard, when you wrote A Briefer History of Time? And I think you're collaborating on another work at this time.
Yeah, we're working on another book now. Well, I have to say that most of all, it's inspirational to work with him, because he has such an impediment and still manages to survive, to keep a good sense of humor, to keep a good attitude. And, you know, we all have our own difficulties that we run into in life. And then you see someone like that who has kept a good spirit through what he's gone through. And it makes you realize that that you can too, no matter what you have to face.
Well, that's true. He's very positive, isn't he?
Yeah.
And you keep plugging through. Now, your book, The Drunkard's Walk, where'd you get that title?
Well, The Drunkard's Walk is a process in mathematics that refers to a kind of random meandering. And it's also called, a little less picturesquely, the random walk. And I felt that was a good metaphor for what we go through in life, because I feel that, and my studies seem to bear this out, that despite our abilities and our planning and the direction that we seem to be going, quite often where we end up getting is the result as much of unpredictable random factors as it is of our hard work and our planning. And so if you would think in some abstract way of the path that we take through life, it's somewhat of a random meandering, as it is in the random process, the drunkard's walk.
We're going to have fun tonight, because I'm a believer in fate, and I don't believe in coincidences. So this can be fun. And by the way, you did a great job with this book. It's not only educational, but it was also kind of funny and fun. And you've got a sense of humor behind you. Did you know that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrote for Night Court at one time, too.
So
I had a sense of humor, but it hasn't been beaten out of me since then.
the scientist writing for Night Court. Now, that was different.
Yeah, that was different.
Well, let's first of all talk about randomness. What is your definition of randomness?
Well, randomness means several things, and it's there's a mathematical definition, and then there's the definition which we'll use in life, which I would like to stick to.
Okay.
Which in some ways means that your path is affected by either unpredictable or unplanned events that happen. So what I'm talking about is that you have a certain deterministic path, you have a certain direction that you're going, you have a certain ability, let's say, at baseball. But even though you have a certain ability at baseball, which might make you on the average a 300 hitter, some days you'll get more hits and some days you'll get less hits. And some years you'll do better and some years you'll do worse. If there was no randomness in life, if everything was predetermined or, as scientists would say, deterministic, that wouldn't really happen. It would be all predictable and it would be constant. But due to other factors that are beyond your control, which are the random factors, there is variation in what happens. And it's that variation that that is what we actually see, because we don't really see a person directly for what they are in general unless we know them very well. We don't see that a baseball player is a 300 hitter. We see that he hits 300 or 310 some years or 280.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to infer from what we observe, from the results that we observe, what is behind it. And one of the points of the book is that that's very hard to do. And if you want to really understand what someone is about, you have to take a lot of effort and use your own brain and study what they're about. But we generally don't do that, and we're not close enough to them. And we look at, if they're a CEO, did they have five good years or three good years? Or if they're a baseball player, how are they doing? And from that, we have to make an inference as to what's behind it. But statistically speaking, we don't really have enough data from just observing someone for a few times, for a few years, for a few quarters. And that's where the problem comes in.
Well, you talked about in your book, and this is a good example, Roger Maris in the year 1961 that he broke Babe Ruth's home run record, albeit even though he did it in more games than Babe, but he still did it. And you talk about that it was probably a fluke. And I wanted to talk to you about that on two fronts, Leonard. One is, of course, anybody who hits 60-plus home runs, I think it's, 61 then,
mm-hmm.
He's got to be pretty good at that time, unless he's got a magic bat or something like that. But at the same time, and this is where I think your thoughts may work here, at the same time, he really didn't have a lot of great years after that and before that. I mean, he was kind of like, you know, you would have expected him to do this all the time, and he didn't, not like Babe Ruth did.
That's right, and Babe Ruth was clearly someone with the ability to do that consistently. And what I claim is that Roger Maris was not, and that this was a what we would call a random fluctuation his great year.
Could it have been, though, that in that year, that fluke year for him, 1961, he put it all together, his abilities put it all together, whatever he possessed, he had it then, and then lost it maybe?
Well, it could have been, and people criticized him for that and said that he cracked up. He had put it all together, gotten great, and then lost it because he couldn't take the pressure. But I thought I would look at it a different way, and I would say that might be. And you can't scientifically prove whether it was one way or the other. But what you can say is, let's look at the other way. Let's look at, could it have been a random fluke? What would that look like? And would that be something that's outrageous and so unlikely that it would never happen? Or is that something that you should actually expect if it was random? And if you do the math, of course, if you take Roger Maris, and you take Roger Maris specifically in 1961, the odds are pretty astronomical that if he's really a person who has the ability, let's say the general ability of hitting about 40 to 45 home runs, depending on his at-bats.
Maybe.
I won't get into the details, but you pick his what you would call his what I call the normal Maris, his normal talent. And then you say that's his normal talent. He has a certain chance of hitting a home run on each at-bat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you say, so each at-bat is like a flip of the coin. It's not 50-50 heads or tails. It's, in this case, 1 in 14.7, I think it was,
okay,
chance of hitting a home run, and the rest of not hitting a home run. And you just say, suppose he flips that coin, I think it was 685 times he came to the plate, and how many home runs would he hit? Well, of course, normally he'd hit this 40 to 45, but because of the random fluctuations of chance, sometimes you'll get more heads or less heads, right? And the question is, how likely is it for him to, even though he normally hits 40 to 45, to come up with 61? And that's very unlikely for him to do in that particular year. And that's true, but when you talk about randomness, you have to be very careful what question you ask. Were we really impressed that Roger Maris hit it in that particular year? Or would we have been just as impressed if someone else of his lower ability than Babe Ruth had broke the record in any other year? In other words, every few years there was a person on the average over history with Roger Maris's talent of, let's say, 40 to 45 home runs. And these guys are always trying to hit 60 home runs. And over the history of baseball, what are the chances that one of them, sometimes they hit more, sometimes they hit less, sometimes they hit their average, what are the chances that one of them would have hit that many more than his average to break Babe Ruth's record? And you can do a mathematical calculation, and it comes out to greater than 50%. So my point is that whether or not you believe that Roger Maris had a magical year and actually his talent improved for 1 year and then went back, the point is that even if that doesn't happen, you should expect Roger Maris's to happen, even if they don't have a magical year, just on the basis of chance. And other scientists who have modeled baseball and done statistical studies always find that everything that happens in baseball is consistent with a chance model, which means that it doesn't mean that there's no differences in ability. If I played baseball for a million years, I would never have hit 61 home runs because my ability is much less than Roger Maris's. The greater your ability, the greater it is that you'll break a record. But the record can still be far from your average, and you'll break it. And people who have modeled baseball find that the records that occur as statistical fluctuations from people with really good talent who have an extra good year because of luck and break the record.
When I was younger, Leonard, you know, you do what young people do on dates, and you go bowling a lot. It's an inexpensive date, and you have some fun, and you do that. I wasn't a particularly good bowler, but there was one game that I had a banner game. I bowled 257 when maybe I was like 130 most of the time. Never able to do it again. I haven't bowled in years. But like Roger Maris, I would guess that was a fluke, because during that one game, everything seemed to work. Everything seemed to click. But after that, I was never able to do that again.
I would agree with you. And the funny thing is, I've had that experience with bowling myself. And it's annoying because you go, come on, I really had it. But you know what's interesting? People tend to believe there's something called the illusion of causality. And you bowl that great game, and you might intellectually say, well, the ball just rolled right for me. It was luck. But you tend to really think, no, I really had something.
I was in the groove.
I don't know. My fingers knew what to do. And there have been psychological studies of this. I mean, there was an interesting study of Yale students tossing. They were guessing coin tosses. And, of course, you can't really guess a coin toss. It's random, and you don't really know how it's going to come out. And if you asked the Yale students, can you guess coin tosses? Do you have ESP? They would have said no. But the psychologists were a little bit more clever than that, and they knew that they would say no, but what do they really feel? Do they feel that they can control it? And to get at that, they asked them slightly modified indirect questions, like they said, they gave them a battery of questions after they flipped the coins. And by the way, the coin flip guessing was engineered so that they always got, each student who participated was guessing 30 flips, and they would each of them guess 15 correctly, because this was manipulated by the coin tosser. So they really were 50-50, as they should be, by chance.
By chance, that's true.
Of course, you know, if you were doing it honestly, someone, as I said, do better, and some would do worse, but this was a controlled study. They wanted them all to do exactly the same. When they asked them the questions, they would ask them something like, would you do better if you practiced? And 40% of them said, yeah, I would. Now, that's funny, because if it's really random, you wouldn't do better by practice, right? But they somehow feel the control, the needs, they feel control.
Yeah.
And when you ask them the questions a little bit indirectly, that comes out. Now, you could slap them around and say, you mean you really think you can guess random coin toss? And they might say, oh, no, I don't know what I was talking about. But they feel that they can. And there are a lot of studies like that. This wasn't a unique study. There are a lot of studies that show that people, even when something they know is random is going on, they behave as if they can control it. And it's the same thing with the bowling ball, and it's the same thing when we observe Roger Maris. You feel like he should have the control. How could it be that this is all random?
Are you a believer in fate at all?
I guess depending what I would imagine is a definition of fate, that something is certain to happen, and however I get pushed around, I'm going to that spot, I would say no.
Well, you know, here's an example. A person is planning to go out for the evening. Something tells them, you know, they didn't want to go, but something tells them, yeah, go out, do this. And so they go, and they go to this place. They run into somebody that ultimately becomes, you know, maybe a lifelong partner or something like that. Had they not shown up, they, one, never would have met that person, at least there. Maybe that's chance. Maybe that's randomness. But I see, I've always believed that there's something else out there that puts these things together, whatever they are, and makes it work. You know, a little beyond that, I guess eventually I've got to ask you if you believe in a divine power, because that's one of the things that pushes me and drives me so much, where your thoughts are truly science and mathematics could be right. But I mean, is it fate? Or is it just randomness when that person goes to this place, meets someone, and, you know, his or her life changes?
I believe that it's randomness, and I believe that this is one of the most important aspects of randomness that people don't often think about, which is, in chaos theory, it's called the butterfly effect. But it's that small changes in a system can lead to very large changes down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And when I call the book The Drunkard's Walk, I'm talking about how a lot of your life is controlled by unpredictable or uncontrollable factors that I call random factors that happen, whether it's you're planning something in business and vendors act the way they shouldn't or do come through, or you meet somebody in life. A lot of things happen to you along the way that you wouldn't know, that you can't control. And this changes your path by quite a bit. And even very small things can have huge effects on your path in life.
Is there any luck involved in any of this?
Well, of course, this is all what we're talking about. It is all, in a sense, luck. There's two components to your path in life and your degree of success and or failure in whatever you do. And one is your ability, which is very important, your hard work, your ability. The other is luck. All this randomness is luck. When it works out, when the randomness happens and has no effect on you, I guess you don't call it luck. But when it has a good effect on you, you call it good luck. When it has a bad effect, you call it bad luck. Yeah. But it's all things that are unpredictable and out of your control.
Well, and you're right about you have to be ready. You have to be trained. You have to be at your best for something good to happen to you. I mean, because you can fall on your face if you're not ready. You know, it could be as simple as someone who's a good auto mechanic. If he's not trained to be a good auto mechanic and that opportunity comes to own his own shop or to work in a place that he likes, if he's not good or skilled or trained, he's going to fall on his face, isn't he?
That's right.
I mean, he gets the chance, but then he loses the opportunity.
That's right. So it takes both components. And people know that it takes preparation. I believe most people understand that. But what they don't understand is that the degree of luck that's involved. I mean, take, for example, a CEO of a company.
All right, hold that thought, because we're going to take this quick break, Leonard. Okay. I'll come right back to you about that, and we'll talk about CEOs and what they do with their ability. It's fascinating. Chance, randomness, luck, fate, as I throw it into the mix here. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating night with our guest, Leonard Mlodinow. We'll be back with him in a moment. His book, The Drunkard's Walk, that's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Leonard Mlodinow. Leonard, how am I doing on your last name?
Oh, you're doing great, George.
Good, good. It's very rarely do you see an M and an L together.
Yes, in this country.
That's true.
In the old country, not so rare.
That's true. You were talking about CEOs and their success rate.
Well, I was going to give an example about this difference between your underlying ability and then the layer of randomness that you put over that and what that does. So let's suppose that you have a CEO or a company that has a 60% chance in any given year of having a successful year, however they want to define that.
Right.
It doesn't really matter. Well, the question is, okay, how does that reflect itself, that let's say potential or that level of ability, how does that reflect itself in the results that we actually observe? Because as I said before, it's hard to observe ability. If you know someone, you can try and estimate their ability. But in general, we observe are the results and we infer what the ability was. So suppose that you take 5 years and you say they had a 60% chance. What would you expect that they would, how many good years would they have out of 5 years? Well, 60% of 5 years is 3 years. So you would expect if the results would match their ability, that you should see someone having 3 out of 5 good years if they have that ability.
Yeah. 3 solid years there.
So however they define the successful years, that would reflect their underlying probability. But when you do the math, you actually find that the chances of having having 3 out of 5 successful years, if your chance each year is 60%, is only about 1 in 3. So 2/3 of the time, if you look at 5 years, it will not reflect correctly the underlying probability.
Okay, and what does that tell you, though?
So what that tells you, well, what do we know? When we look at someone, we say, hey, he had 5 good years. He must be great. He must be a home run hitter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But he might be a 60% hitter. He might be, you know, much less than that. In fact, 10% of the people who have a 60% ability in 5 years will have either 5 good or 5 bad years. So when you look at someone's results, this is called sarcastically by psychologists the law of small numbers. I call it the illusion of small numbers, because there's a law in mathematics that says if you take a large number of years, okay, if a person has a 60% ability, whatever their ability is, if you look at over a large number of years, it will tend to reflect that underlying ability. It will tend to reflect it very well. If you look at 1,000 years, you'll get pretty close to 600. But if you look at a small number of years, as we can see by this example, it doesn't work that way. So we look at someone, he had 5 bad years, or he had 5 good years, and you think he's a star, or he's a goat. But really, he's just one of these average 60% CEOs. But you can't tell that by looking at the results, because we don't have enough data. And this happens in sports a lot. People, right now, the NBA championships are going on. They play 7 games, and you think the best team in 7 games is going to win.
Which is not the case.
Which is not the case, not at all. In fact, not even close.
Sometimes the best team gets eliminated before they even have a real chance.
That's right. Well, you can say that, but a lot of times people think that when they look at the results of the championships, that must be true, and they were wrong about who was the best team. Or they think that one of the other teams got really good for the championships and kind of got it together.
Well, you could always say that the best team for the moment won the championship.
You could always define it to be that way if you wanted to. But you know, here's an example. If you take two teams that play head-to-head, and you expect that one team, say, has a 55-45 advantage over the other, that means when they play head-to-head, they would win 55% of the time, and the other team 45. That's actually a pretty lopsided, you know, in championships, they're actually pretty much closer than that. But suppose you had that and you played a 7-game series. What are the chances that the lesser team will win a 7-game series?
Not as high.
They come out to 40%.
Yeah, okay.
That's pretty high.
Well, that is high, but I wouldn't have thought it would be that high.
It doesn't seem like it would be, but 7 games isn't enough. You know how many games you need to determine the better team to what scientists call statistical significance? Statistical significance means that 95% of the time, the better team really will win. Only 5% of the time will the lesser team win.
All right, here's one for you.
Let me just tell you, how many games do you think you need this World Series to be to determine that in this situation?
Well, there's a 7-game series.
7 wasn't enough. You need more, right? 7, you had a 40% chance of the lesser team winning.
So 9 or 10?
You need 269 games.
269
games. You need, you know, people would stop watching probably.
That's
after
a long
30
season.
40, wouldn't you think?
They'd be playing right into their spring training.
They'd play whole seasons, just two teams against each other if you wanted to be scientific about it. But what I'm saying is that in real life, in sports or in business, you just don't get enough data to determine what's underlying it. You have to work harder. You have to use your head, and you have to examine and make your own judgments. But don't just look at the results.
Here we are. I don't know how my Red Wings, if they play tonight or not, but they were up 3-0 over Dallas in hockey. And they said that 155 teams so far in the history of the NHL have been up 3-0. And then they listed the amount of games necessary for those teams to win. But I think 2 teams lost. Out of 155 teams that were up 3-1, 2 teams finally got eliminated, being up 3-0. That's all statistics and randomness in mathematics. And I think one could conclude then, when you look at these statistics, that the Red Wings will eventually beat the Dallas Stars and go off to the next level in hockey, right? That would be accurate.
The Red Wings are up 3-0.
Right.
Yeah, you would conclude they probably would.
And if they don't, then you see this very minute percent, 2 out of 155, that they would not make it.
Yeah, and that's pretty good numbers for statistics if you have that many records.
Is it?
Of course, yeah, but this is you have to go back. The problem is that different years you have different degrees of lopsidedness between the teams, right? They're probably not 50-50 or even 55-45 at the earlier levels. They probably are pretty lopsidedly matched, right?
Well, like by the way, Dallas, it's now 3-1. Dallas won tonight. Oh, wow.
I remember once when I was a kid, I think it was St. Louis against Detroit in the World Series, and it was 3-0. And I was pretty sure that was a shoe-in then. And I bet a dime against the dollar. And they won 4 in a row, and I lost my dollar.
Well, is that
back when a dollar meant something too?
That was that when Kurt Flood missed that fly ball?
I don't really remember. All I remember is losing a dollar. I don't even remember if Detroit came up and won or St. Louis. You know, of course, I was a Cubs fan. It didn't really matter. I hated St. Louis, but other than that.
Well, assuming all this is correct, that randomness rules our lives, which is a subtitle of your book, The Drunkard's Walk, what does that do to us in terms of our own, I guess, our own ability to control our destiny? Can we? Are you saying we can't? I always thought that we had free choice, that we could control the direction we're going to go. Our choices had a tremendous effect on our future and our kids' futures.
Our choices do have a effect, and it may be a tremendous effect, but there's another player, and that's randomness, which has a tremendous effect also. And certainly you should do your best to make the best choices and to prepare yourself. But you can't insulate yourself from the other part of it. So you can't guarantee, there's no guarantees, and you can't guarantee that if you do everything right, it's still going to work out. But on the other hand, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't necessarily mean that you did something wrong, and you don't have to necessarily kick yourself.
Well, let's look at these poor people in China. These poor people in China who have died or who have been trapped because of this 7.8 magnitude earthquake. I'm sure in the morning when they all woke up, none of them thought, well, maybe a few did, but most of them didn't say, I'm going to get killed by an earthquake today. The fact that they did, I think that's pure randomness. But is it also fate, somehow telling someone you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and destiny puts them there? You would say no.
I would say no, but that's a matter of faith. That's not a scientific question. Now, if you're asking, is there a God who said, you're going to get
it.
You know, in my book, I talk in the beginning about my own reason for being in the world. And, you know, we all know that the Holocaust was a horrible thing and Hitler was a bad guy, right? But, you know, my father had a family with two kids and a wife who were all killed by Hitler. And if it hadn't been for Hitler, I wouldn't even be here. And that just kind of shows you the just wild randomness of life, you know. And
true.
And can you say that
that's
well,
life? See, that's life.
God fated my dad's other family to die because they were bad or something that we don't understand. Only God understands why God did that. And I find that hard to buy. I just think it was, you know, wrong place, wrong time. But they weren't, singled out by God for anything that they did.
See, I don't think God controls things like that. I mean, some people do. Very religious people believe that everything is done by God's hand. I don't believe that. I don't believe that it's God who says you're going to get hit by a car today and die. I just think that is, you know, a series of everything, either carelessness on the driver's part or the person who hits them. But I do think that there's a factor in here, and I've always believed this, Leonard. There's something else in there that sometimes gives us the ability to change that before it happens. I will always believe that, you know, till the day I die, that if we can tune ourselves into touching this, whatever it is in the universe that is out there, it could change our destiny. You know, it may tell you, and it's happened to me. Here's an example. I was driving up at an intersection one day, and I've said this before in the program, and the light was green, so it's time for me to go. And as I'm getting closer to the intersection with the green light, I stop. I just stop. There are cars behind me. I stop. I'm doing the dumbest thing a driver can do. Stop. But something told me don't go through the intersection, George. Just don't do it. And, man, as God is my judge, Leonard, somebody goes flying through the red light that they had, and it would have hit me broadside. I mean, it could have killed me. I don't think that's randomness. I think something in me told me, whether it's a guardian angel or intuitiveness, don't do this. Because that doesn't happen to me all the time. I don't come up to an intersection every moment and get that cold, clammy feeling. I don't. So how do you explain that?
Well, I would explain that, and that I don't know what the, you know, I don't know that I can explain it, but what comes to mind is that that you're, you know, unconscious of picking up some signal that you weren't aware of. You know how we have hunches sometimes?
Yes.
We don't really know why, but we feel something. And scientists who study those things have realized that there's a lot of wisdom in those hunches. And what it is it's our unconscious mind. It's not just our conscious mind that processes information. It's also our unconscious mind. We've evolved this way because, you know, back in the wild when we had to escape from saber-toothed tigers and whatever was chasing us, we had to make very quick decisions. And our conscious mind kind of sits there, has coffee, smokes a cigarette, goes this way, that way, A, B, C, I don't know, let me think about it. Our unconscious mind immediately makes a judgment, right? And it works on a level that we're not even aware of. What comes to our awareness is simply the conclusion. And there have been a lot of studies on this that you know, we can talk about later if you want. But I think what happened was that your unconscious mind picked up something. Maybe it was, I don't know, some horns in the background because people were getting out of the way, or maybe you could hear that the car was going, and something told you, danger, danger, you know, danger, Will Robinson, stop.
Yeah.
And all you knew was you had a hunch you had to stop, and now you're interpreting it backwards and saying, well, you know, it was a higher power, but it was you, I think, the higher power, and you knew something was wrong. You sensed it, and you stopped.
Well, couldn't you say, though, that your unconscious mind somehow has an ability to tap into things that are out there? What if, for example, my consciousness, okay, that's the broader stroke for all of this, tapped into that other driver's consciousness, and he's saying, I'm going through this light, or I'm daydreaming, and somehow those two things connect, and I get the message, and it saves me. Would you believe that could happen?
Well, as a scientist, I believe anything could happen. And you know what? People have, throughout history, believed that they knew the final theory, and then some data came up, some new observation, they had to revise it. The way I would approach it is to just look at the preponderance of evidence and to, you know, if you were studying it scientifically, to try and design some experiments to study this. But if you believe it as a matter of faith, that's a different story. One way is to say, well, what's more likely? Is this likely to have happened, or is it more likely that you picked up some unconscious cues? And you might study that experimentally. The other way of looking at it is, I like you said, you're going to go to your grave with this. So why do experiments? Because you're going to go to your grave believing this anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's a matter of faith, and faith is not a question that you do experiments about. It's what you believe. And that's, you know, that's, I have nothing against that, and I like to speculate about those things myself. That's why I wrote science fiction.
Yeah. Well, does someone like Stephen Hawking, does he have that? Does he have that faith within him? I would think he would have to, going through what he went through.
The faith of higher power controlling his life.
Or being able to tap into that higher power for himself.
I don't think that he does. I think he believes, he's a scientist, and he believes in, doesn't believe in supernatural. He believes that everything happens according to the laws of physics.
I had a story yesterday. They're auctioning off tomorrow, as a matter of fact, a letter from Albert Einstein where he talked about God in the Bible is childish, and he was not a believer either.
Yeah, it's funny. Einstein, when he was young, I think as a child, did believe in God. And as he got, even as to a teenager, I think he began to believe in physics. but he, you know, he kind of did believe in a God, but not the kind of a God that takes any interest in, you know, in humans. But if you're a physicist, you know, there it doesn't have to be called God, but you know, things follow certain laws, and that's pretty amazing. And, you know, you can just call the fact that things follow laws your God in a way. But it's not the kind of God that the Bible talks about.
Well, here's an example, too, Leonard. If the phone's ringing and you go, I know that's my mother, you pick it up and you go, hello, and there she is. Is that random? Or
Well, those types of incidents are pretty well understood because, you know, there are times where you make those, you know, where you draw those conclusions and you're wrong and you just forget about them. You don't really remember them. And of course, when they're right, you do remember them. And there are many different possible things as you go through life where you go, oh, you know, you make wild guesses and generally you just forget them and they don't come true. And, you know, sometimes they do. Or sometimes you might have had a good reason to think your mother's calling. You know, again, subconsciously you knew that your mother was going to call, but consciously you weren't aware that you knew it.
So you would say, and maybe accurately, George, you get 100 phone calls a day, and 82 of them are from your mother.
The chances are probably not that slim. Oh, there are tremendous coincidences that have happened that really people think could never occur. But when you analyze them mathematically, you find out that actually, you know, that they can. I mean, there is a story about a church that where I think 10 people met for some kind of a club, organization mm-hmm. of the church. They met every Tuesday night. And one Tuesday night, the church blew up. Something happened. The whole church blew up. Would have killed them all. But guess what? All 10 of them were late that day. And they're, you know, they're talking about what are the chances of that God had intervened and made them, because normally they're not late, and they were like each 20 minutes late or something.
And would you say that's random?
Yeah. The things like that, you know what, here's the way you have to look at it. The chances of that might be one in a million, but there's a million such things that could happen. And so eventually one of these small probability things does happen. So you have to really analyze them all very carefully, no matter how outlandish they seem. I mean, in the book I talk about something a little bit more business related, but there was a guy whose mutual fund beat the Standard & Poor's 15 years in a row.
I would say he's good.
You would say he's good, and you would say, you know, what are the chances of that? And people were saying they're 1 in 100,000, 1 in 300,000, 1 in a billion. If you just say he's flipping coins and he has a 50% chance for 15 years in a row, he better have a 50% chance of beating him. Otherwise, why are you investing with him? You know,
exactly.
But if he had a 50% chance, the chance is about 1 in 32,000 that he would have done that. And that sounds like, you know, a damn big coincidence, if it's a coincidence, that he must have something going for him.
Hey, Leonard, stick around. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour as well and give it to everybody an opportunity to chat with you about this. The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.